Welcome to the Boston Book Fest, everybody. So this is the panel, YA, It's Complicated. So we're going to be talking about all kinds of relationships in these wonderful books that are up here. So I'll start off with introducing the authors, and then we'll do some questions. We'll open it up for you guys to ask some questions, so think up some good ones, some really good ones, okay? And then we're going to have a signing, and that'll be in the room out there, right? And you guys can also buy all the books, all the awesome books, buy all those books. So it'll be right outside. All right. I will start with Jordan. He's right here. His book is Falling Over Sideways, and I'm going to have him talk about it after. But he is the author of critically acclaimed novels for teens and young readers, Notes from the Midnight Drivers, Zen and Art of Faking It, and the Dodger and Me series. His first novel, Drummer Girls and Dangerous Pie, was published in Dangerous Pies, I'm sorry. Was published in 2005 as part of the Go the Distance Literacy Initiative. And his book, Falling Over Sideways, earned starred reviews from Booklist, Publishers Weekly, and Kirkus. Yay!
Kirkus, that's something.
Yeah. Okay. Jennifer, New York Times and internationally bestselling author of many genres, including the Velvet Jean books, All the Bright Places, and won the Goodreads 2015 Choice Award for Best Young Fiction and was named Best Book of the Year by publications including Time Magazine, NPR, and Publishers Weekly. Her book, Holding Up the Universe, just came out this month and hit the New York Times bestseller list. Yeah. Rebecca Potos, author and agent extraordinaire. Her fiction has been published in Glimmer Train, Paper Darts, Bellow American Review, and Smoke Long Quarterly. She's won prizes for her work, including the Hellman Award for Short Fiction and the Hellerman McGarrity Scholarship for Creative Writing. Her debut book, The Mystery of Hollow Places, received a starred review from Booklist, and her next novel, Like Water, is slated for 2017. And then Melissa de la Cruz, a best-selling author of many acclaimed and award-winning novels for all ages, which includes Isle of the Lost, the prequel to the number one bestseller, The Isle of the Lost, inspired by Disney movies, the Blue Blood series, The Witches of East End, a semi-autobiographical novel, Fresh Off the Boat, just to name a few, a very few, and her newest novel, Something in Between, just also published this month. I think yours came out last month. And now they're going to talk about their books.
Okay.
Do you
want to
go first?
Okay, sure.
We'll go down the line.
Okay, so Falling Over Sideways is, so I guess it's complicated. We're talking about relationships. I have a 15-year-old daughter, and when she was 13 and in the eighth grade, she came home every day for like the first month of eighth grade, and I was home because writers, we usually work at home. And I'd say, hey, honey, how was your day? And she would just burst into tears. And as the father of a teenage girl, that's like panic mode, you know? So my daughter would burst into tears, and I'd be like, hi, want a cookie? I didn't know what to do. And I'd say, do you want to talk about it? And she'd go, no. And I'd be, do you want advice? And she'd go, no. And I'd go, you want me to leave? And she'd go, stay. And so it would be this weird hostage situation where I'd be sitting next to her in this panic. And I've been asking girls this at school visits. If you're female, raise your hand if you ever had one of those weird, awkward times with your dad where you felt like he wasn't understanding, but you were upset. Okay, yeah, so this book was my attempt to bridge that gap. I spent a four-day weekend with my daughter. I took her away for a vacation on one of my speaking trips to Seattle, Washington. And we spent 4 days together just laughing and hanging out and doing every touristy thing we could. And I just listened to her voice. I just listened for 4 days. And then on the way home, she fell asleep on the plane. I was watching her sleep, and I thought, your voice is so good. Your voice is so funny. She's kind of fiery and peppery and sarcastic. And I thought, you would be such a great character. You're a great daughter, but you'd be a great character. And so this book is about a girl with all of my daughter's characteristics, and she has all the difficult, tangled eighth grade female relationships and boy-girl frenemy relationships and complicated relationship with her dad. And then one day at breakfast, she's home alone with her dad. She's just had a big argument with him, and her dad falls over sideways. And that's about what happens next.
This is my second young adult book, Holding Up the Universe. And it came about I really wrote it for three reasons. One, I really struggled with my weight when I was 12 and 13, which is something one of my characters does. And two, I have a cousin who is 15, and he has something called prosopagnosia. It's also known as face blindness. And it means basically he can't recognize anyone's faces, not his mom's face, not his sister's faces, not even his own face. And I was really fascinated by this and how he finds the people he loves in the world. And he said, you know, I remember them by the important things, like how many freckles they have or how nice they are. And I thought, oh my God, wouldn't it be wonderful if that was how we saw people in this world. And then the third component that went into writing this was really meeting and hearing from readers all over the world after All the Bright Places came out. Because the thing that I hear the most is, thank you so much for letting me know that I'm not alone and that I matter. And I thought, I want to write something directly to my readers, and it's dedicated to my readers. Just to let them know that. And so what came out of it is this story about a boy and a girl. It's told in dual narration, like All the Bright Places was. And the boy has a secret that he's trying to hide behind a lot of swagger and a lot of charm. He can't recognize faces, so he suspects he has this condition called prosopagnosia. He's terrified that people will find out about it because he doesn't want to be mocked. He doesn't want to be the center of attention in a really bad way. And also, it could be dangerous if people know this. He could be mugged. I mean, there are all sorts of things that could happen. So he's trying to hide this. And Libby is my girl character. And Libby is going back to school for the first time in 5 years. She has been homeschooled following the death of her mom. I lost my mom just before I started writing this book, and so I kind of poured my grief into it, and I gave Libby my wonderful, amazing mother. And so Libby was reeling after that. She also was bullied as a child, and it all became too much for her, and she shut down, and she didn't want to leave the house, and she began to eat. And the media also bullied her. It wasn't just her peers. They called her America's fattest teen, because she's best known for the girl as being the girl who had to be freed from her own house. But she is so strong. She's lost some weight, but she still weighs about 300 pounds, and she's going back to school for this first time. She's going to be a junior, and she and Jack meet through a really terrible, vicious high school prank that Jack gets involved in because he's so scared of being found out. They get detention, and through that, they really learn to see not only each other, but more than that, they learn to find their places in the world and really see themselves clearly. Jack's always looking for his identifier. What's the identifier? That's how he finds people in the world, and he's trying to figure out his. And so this is really a love story about finding themselves.
That's lovely. So The Mystery of Hollow Places is my debut novel, and it's the story of Imogene Scott, who's the daughter of a mystery writer, a popular medical mystery writer, and she grew up reading his books and then also reading Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and Agatha Christie. And when her father goes missing, it's not a spoiler, it happens like a chapter in, she determines to set out and find him using the skills that she's gained from his books and from reading mysteries and from loving mysteries. And I wanted to write a character like that because I grew up loving mysteries. And I think there's just something extraordinarily comforting about the narrative structure of a mystery. Like, you have all these questions and uncertainties, but you know if you just get to the end of the book, then you'll have your answer. And, like, everything will be settled. And you could go about your day because, like, there's nothing left to solve. So it's really comforting, but it's not how life works. It's not the way relationships work, thesis of the panel, and it's not how mental illness works. That's a big conversation in the book because Imogene's father is living with bipolar disorder. And I think we've all known and loved people who are living with mental illness, and it's not, there aren't fast answers, there aren't easy solutions, and there aren't neat endings. So I really wanted a detective character who started out believing in the narrative structure of a mystery and believing that if she could just find the answer, not only like where her father is, but who her father is, where she comes from, you know, who her family really is. She believes if she can just follow the clues across like noir winter Massachusetts and find that answer, then everything will be solved. And in the end, she realizes life isn't like that. And what I really wanted the most was a book where, a mystery where the twist wasn't you think the answer is A, but it's really B. But a mystery where it's you think the answer is A, but like who told you there were simple answers to life and who told you this was all going to be easy. So that's what I tried to do in The Mystery of Hollow Places. So.
Well, the books sound awesome, so I'll be on your line. I'm first, okay? So my book is Something in Between, and it is the first book in the 17 magazine imprint at Harlequin Teen. I was asked to write the book because 17 focuses on real-life issues that teenagers face, and they actually contacted me and said, would you be interested in writing a book about immigration? I said, okay, what specifically? And they said, you know, a character who is an illegal immigrant. And I said, oh, okay. And I kind of felt like, you know, I couldn't say no. I was an immigrant to this country. I came to the States when I was 13 years old from the Philippines. And I felt like I could, you know, tell that story. You know, I had a lot of sympathy for, you know, that situation. And I could do a lot of research. But also, you know, as an immigrant, you know, we just knew a lot of people who were in that same situation, who had problems like that. And as somebody who went through, you know, the immigration process, while I came here at 13, I didn't get my citizenship until I was 40. And, you know, so I just know about all the cracks that happens and the bureaucracy. I also accepted the gig because I had already written about my own family. So I had written a book called Fresh Off the Boat, which was published in 2005, and that was about a Filipino teenager and her family, and they were immigrants from the Philippines. So I thought, oh, I can do this because you know, my family would be so relieved that they're not in this book because I've already written about them. So, phew. But, you know, all that being said, the heart of the book is my heart, you know, and even though it's not autobiographical, there's a lot in it that we went through as a family, too. So it's about Jasmine De Los Santos, who's a 17-year-old senior, and she is a Filipino-American, and she gives up all the fun teenage stuff. You know, she doesn't go to parties, she has no boyfriend, she's never even kissed a boy, because she's so focused on her future. And it's all about, you know, going to college, going to a good college, living the American dream. And she wins this national scholarship to any college of her choice because she's valedictorian, class president, head cheerleader, you know, the classic overachiever. And everybody always asks me, are you Jasmine? Was that you? And I always have to say, you know, there's parts of her that are me, but I wasn't that well put together at that age. You know, Jasmine is more 18 going on 40. And she actually was based on a really good friend of mine who was a Filipino beauty contest winner, valedictorian, head cheerleader, you know, pre-med, you know, she wanted to be a doctor, just somebody so driven and ambitious, whereas I always feel like I was more like Royce, who is the boy in the story, because he's a little bit more unsure of himself, and he's the one who wants to be a writer. So in writing the book, I was like, oh my God, I'm like Royce. So Royce is my favorite. anyway, so she wins the scholarship, and she tells her parents, expecting them to call their relatives in the Philippines and brag about her and be so excited, you know, everything's happening finally. And instead, they tell her that she can't accept it because they're in the country illegally, and she's an undocumented immigrant. So her whole world shatters. You know, everything she's worked for, you know, suddenly, you know, she can't have. And the book is about how she picks up the pieces of her American dream and what she does, and, you know, about the family's kind of journey through the immigration process. And she meets Royce, who is the son of the leading congressman against immigration reform. So it's a little bit of a Romeo and Juliet story, and they kind of have to bridge the gap between them. And it's also about what privilege is and what richness is, you know, because on the page, it feels like, you know, Jasmine is, you know, the less privileged one. But when you meet her family and you see what Royce, you know, how he's not confident and he has all these things, you know, it kind of tells you about what, you know, what it really means to have privilege and to be rich. So anyway, that's my book.
Great. Oh, wait. No.
So while reading all you guys' books, I noticed that one theme in them all was that all the girls were kind of daddy's girls, their favorite. And two of them don't have their mothers, but I was kind of wondering how, I kind of figured out how yours is, but I'd still like to hear a little bit about how that theme kind of is so normal and even seen in any type of show. There's always the daddy's girl and the mama's boy, and the daddy's girl's kind of played a pretty good role in here, and I wonder if there were mothers in your two books, if that would still be a big role in it. So
okay, if we move, I guess straight across again. For me, I had killed off lots of dads, or had lots of really awful, semi-useless dads in other books I had written, and I wanted to write one book where the dad was useful and a practical, helpful part of his kid's teen life, and also. My daughter and I, a book has to have a time clock. A book has to have a time bomb ticking to generate suspense and to generate a structure of time. And when my daughter was in eighth grade, all the girls at my daughter's dance school, where she takes dance, if you're 14 and older, you can be in this big finale number at the dance recital called the Dad's Dance. And the girls and their dads have this big finale where we all come out, and the dads have to go to 9 Monday nights of rehearsal with their daughters, and then there are 3 nights of dress rehearsal, and then there are 4 shows. It's a huge commitment. And my daughter had been looking forward to this forever. And when she was in eighth grade, that was the year when she was going to do it. In fact, I'm wearing this shirt because it's the shirt I wore to be in Dad's Dance when my daughter was in eighth grade. And she'd been looking forward to this forever. And I thought that the time ticking thing is going to be my daughter. The girl in the book has been looking forward to Dad's Dance forever. And then her dad falls over sideways, has this medical emergency, and that is threatened. So the relationship in my book between the father and the daughter, it becomes very urgent because of that. But for me, the big start of it was I had never written about a functional dad, and I felt kind of really guilty because I really had a great dad, and I wanted to write a book with a functional dad.
I had a great dad, and he's gone as well. I had a great dad, but then when I turned 13, my dad didn't really know what to do with me, so we kind of became, like, friendly, like, you know, but we would stay kind of to our sides in the house, and he would be like, he would talk to my mom and say, Penelope, you need to talk to your daughter. I don't know what she's doing right. I don't know what this emotion is or what is happening with her. And she would say, Jack, you know, she's still your daughter. You need to talk to her. And so we went through this kind of struggle in high school. And initially, I wrote Libby's dad like that. I knew that the mom would not be there just because I was dealing with my own mom loss. And I was definitely a mama's girl. I always have been. But my dad and I, like later in life, became really good friends. And so I think the relationship I wrote was really where we were later with that. in our relationship. And I wanted Libby, because Jack has some home problems. Like, he's going through some things at home. The biggest, which he's having a problem with his dad, because his dad is having an affair, and Jack knows about this. And so there's a struggle there. But I wanted Libby to have a really good dad. Her dad is all she has, and I want them to have, it's really like a really good friendship that they have. He's still her dad, but I just wanted to see that on paper. And because so much of the world kind of turned against her for a while, it was especially important that she have that at home.
Mm. Imogene's main relationship is with her father, because he's there. Her mother is a figure in the novel. She's kind of the greatest mystery in the book. So I guess someone had to be missing, either her mother or her father. But I think in the end I had settled on Imogene's relationship being with her father was because I really liked the Holmes-Watson dynamic, which is something that kind of factors into the book. You know, Holmes is like the genius, like the troubled genius character who's this runaway train, and then Watson is running behind him being like, okay, please eat a meal, get some sleep, do less coke and then less heroin as well. And just like picking up the pieces. So, you know, like Holmes gets a lot of the credit, but he needs a Watson. And so for me, just like Holmes was kind of formed in the, you know, idea of her father who is troubled for a lot of reasons, doesn't maybe get a lot of sleep, stays up too late writing medical mysteries. And then Imogene was his Watson figure. And when, you know, there's no saying that the primary Holmes figure can't be a woman, because then when he goes missing, Imogene has to step up and assume the sort of Holmes role, and her best friend Jessa kind of steps up into that little Watson slot, or at least that's what Imogene thinks she's doing. I think it could have been her mother as this Holmesian figure. It would have been a slightly different dynamic, just from what I remember of my teenage relationship with my mother, which was, yeah, loving, but somewhat more contentious, I think, than between me and my father, just, you know, facts. So it really could have been either, but I think it was just, like, that's the way he was formed in my mind, is just sort of, like, this mysterious, like, brilliant, slouching kind of guy, and that's maybe who he is, yeah.
Yeah, no, I think I was thinking that when Jordan asked if we had all you know, had that uncomfortable moment with our dad, and you know, where he loved you but didn't understand you. And I didn't raise my hand because my dad, you know, it was not that. I mean, we were kind of kindred spirits. We were born on the same. We shared the same birthday, so I always felt very special. He was very. We were very close. We had the same sense of humor. But what happened in my family was that, you know, my dad was the fun one, you know, and he got to do all the fun stuff. And then when we got to that awkward teenager phase, you know, and I would be rebelling, or I would be, you know, kind of mad at my parents because they were quite strict, so I couldn't do a lot of things. So there was a lot of, you know, kind of me being annoyed. And it would always be my mom who dealt with it. And I remember my dad would be like, you have to talk to mom. So he was just, you know. So in that way, I think it preserved the relationship in that way. And my mom probably, you know, it was like a good cop, bad cop kind of thing, where my dad got to, you know, be the fun one, and my mom had to deal with, you know, all the not fun stuff. So I think because that relationship is a little bit more complicated, and my dad kind of got off like a saint a little bit, you know, I don't know, I think it's important, you know, the whole trend in children's fiction, you know, is really, you know, the parents are kind of gone or they're not there because then the kids can do a lot of fun stuff. You know, I think I was also kind of tired of that a little bit. I wanted to show, you know, a family that functioned, you know, that was supportive, you know, and the mom is in the book very much so, and they have a much, you know, kind of like my mom and I had like a close but a little bit more contentious relationship, whereas dad was always like, you know, incredibly supportive and just there and just made jokes, you know, and kind of made you feel better, so.
I love how you talked about your dance.
I didn't say I was good at the dance. I just said I did it. But yeah.
So another aspect in all of your books is that the main character has a lot of pressure put onto them by their parents or their parents' circumstances, whether they have to be the moderator or even when Libby kind of holds back on telling her father things to protect him, and that kind of shows them growing up a lot quicker than their peers and kind of pushing their peers away a little bit, like you don't understand what's going on. Can you talk a bit about your process in coming up with that?
Sure. One of my big concerns as a parent is that I get really severe migraines. And so several times, they're pretty well controlled now, but when they weren't, there were several times when my daughter was little or younger when I'd have to, you know, get rushed to the hospital and I'd have to be in the emergency room once I had to stay overnight. And I was thinking when I was writing this about the look on my daughter's face when she came into the, you know, the hospital room and I was staying overnight and she had to see me with two IVs in me and all the fear in her when she saw me all wired up. And it did force her, I think kids who have had to deal with a parent who was in a lot of pain or kids who have had to deal with a parent in a scary situation like that, it does change the dynamic of the parent-child situation because there's this fear of getting close to your parent for a while after that, this fear of like your parent is fragile then, they might break. It changes the dynamic. And because my daughter and I tend to have a very laughing relationship and a very jokey relationship and a very warm relationship, it was very painful for me to see her being kind of afraid to bridge that gap again. So a lot of what goes on in my book is the daughter learning how to bridge that gap again and not be afraid to get near her dad after his incident, after what happens to him medically in the book, which is that he has a stroke. She's very afraid to get close again. And it's about learning to reapproach your dad, which was something I was very worried about with both of my kids because they did see me, you know, really injured.
I've experienced a lot of loss in my life. It's, as I said, certainly something Libby goes through in this book. And the thing about loss, it ages you, whether you want it to or not, very quickly. And so I knew that Libby had that, and her dad was very protective of her and has always been. But he got a lot of criticism from the media when Libby is freed from her house. They start blaming her father, and she's so protective of him. So that's one reason, you know, when she's like goes to school and people, you know, bad things happen and everything, she can deal with it. She's such a strong survivor now, and she wants to protect him as much as she can because he's been protecting her for all this time. And then Jack, too, is dealing with this because his father's had cancer, and he had an affair. And they kind of, because of cancer, you know, Jack's like, I'm not allowed to be mad at him because he survived cancer, but I'm mad at him because he's cheated on my mom. He may still be doing that. And it's a very complicated, you know, situation for him. And it's one reason he doesn't want to come forward with this thing that he suspects he has, because he doesn't want to put any more burden on his parents because he can see the struggle that they're dealing with already. And he's protective, especially of his mother, because of what she's been going through. And so I think that both of them, in many ways, and that's where the title comes from, they're really holding up the universe. And I think that it's certainly something I felt as a teen. That's the first time I remember feeling like I was holding up the universe and like in any way I had to protect my parents. My parents got divorced when I was 18, and they were separated before that, and there's always been a question about whether my dad met his second wife before my mom, you know, when that exactly happened. So I remember then becoming very protective of my mother, and that's something that stayed with me my whole life. And so this is just, this is what they're doing.
Good God, we're the same person. It's no wonder.
It's kind of scary, isn't it?
Yeah.
I know.
So the pressure on Imogen, well, so first of all, Imogen's father has bipolar disorder, but he's not in the book. Like nobody is, just their mental illness. He's a good father, and they have a loving relationship. For the most part, they have a functioning partnership. They actually, how they met, her stepmother in the book, who's a psychologist, is through family therapy. So, but one of the things, you know, I said I think we've all loved someone who's living with mental illness. And if it's someone who's close to you, whether it's a parent or a best friend or a partner, I think sometimes you can put pressure on yourself to be extra okay. And to kind of look at that behavior and do the opposite, not because it's who you are or what you want to be doing, but it's because you think this is what an okay person does. So Imogene does put some pressure on herself like that. Like if her father will stay home, she will go out to a party, but lean against the wall and not talk to people, all the while assuring herself like this is normal and healthy behavior, you're doing it. And it's not a very large part of the book, but it definitely is a part of her character, and it is something that she's dealing with, in addition to the responsibility that she's putting on herself to just, like, practically find her father. And I think one of the big things in the book, the primary relationship other than between Imogene and her father is between her and her best friend, who is the kind of best friend that you guys were just like born a block away from each other and you were always friends, and you have to get to a certain point in your relationship and reevaluate it for what it is and figure out like what is our relationship, like what is connecting us other than the fact that we were just born near each other and we've always been together. And so when Imogene starts relying more on her best friend, and her best friend kind of starts to step up into more of that supporting and caring role and taking care of her in the way that she's been taking care of her father, I think she does start to sort of re-examine those behaviors and what it means to actually be in a healthy relationship and what it means to, I don't know, behave in a way that's true to you as opposed to just the opposite way of what you think a lonely person would be acting like or a depressed person would be acting like. So I guess that's the general sense of pressure on Imogene during the book.
Yeah, so a lot of immigrant kids or kids of immigrants, you know, kind of grow up quickly because they need to sometimes translate for their parents or somehow they, you know, because they can, you know, kind of move through American society a lot easier, you know, they kind of are the cultural, you know, translator or representative for their parents who are maybe a little bit more shy, more timid, you know, coming from a culture that's not, you know, doesn't speak up for themselves so much. So a lot of that, when Jasmine finds out that, you know, they're undocumented, you know, her anger comes from, she says, I'm American. I'm resourceful. Like, I'm not timid. I'm not shy. I wouldn't stand for this. So she's kind of angry at her parents for, you know, being so scared, you know, and she's kind of this confident American girl. And that, you know, definitely came a little bit from my own experience too, you know, and just feeling like I was a little bit different from my peers and feeling like I grew up a little bit faster, you know, just kind of, I mean, my parents spoke English and all that, but I remember at one point my dad's, he had business and, you know, he couldn't pay my sister's tuition, her college tuition. I was 22, and I had just gotten out of college myself, and you know, I loaned them money, and I remember feeling this immense pressure to help the family in any way, and also feeling like, oh my God, you know, there's, you know, if my dad is asking me for help, and it was, you know, there was no cushion for me, you know, and I felt so different from my peers who were, you know, just partying and going out to bars, living in New York, you know, where I was trying to figure out how to help my dad pay tuition. So, you know, so that kind of came into, you know, where Jasmine is. You know, she basically is the one who gets her family to, you know, hire an attorney to try to figure out how they can stay in the country. So you just kind of grow up as an adult and, you know, you don't let the pressure kill you. I think it was one of the best things that happened, you know, not only to see your parents as real people. You know, I mean, it kind of takes that film away, you know, they become real to you and you empathize and sympathize with them, you know, so.
So this is the last question from me, and it's more of the relationship of the story that your book tells, which is kind of a bit sad. Well, not sad, but it's kind of hard topics, but the way you all write it with kind of this silly, humorous, or even sarcastically witty type of style. It just blends it all in such a nice relationship in your book. And I'd like to kind of talk about how you wrote such hard-hitting stories with such humorous intentions.
Okay. Well, for me, I was lucky because people say, like, oh, it's your first book writing in the voice of a female character. You've written 9 guys. How could you write a girl? You know, how did you conceptualize writing a female character? And I was very lucky. I wasn't writing randomly constructing a female character from the blue. It was just my daughter, and I was lucky. My daughter's funny. I really didn't have that much work to do. I get these texts from my daughter. I'm reaching in the wrong pocket. This is a text I got from my daughter, panicked 2 days ago. And then this is just my daughter's voice. So on a random day, I'll be walking down the street, you know, on tour, thinking about my authory stuff, and I get this text from my daughter. Mom is apparently getting rid of movies. She almost got rid of Airplane because she said, well, you just watched it, so I figured you wouldn't watch it again. SMH. I had to save our Christmas specials, too. We can't get rid of Charlie Brown. Anyway, I thought you may want to save some of the following. Annie Hall, Grown Ups, Blazing Saddles, Caddyshack, Die Hard, Sister Act. Let me know which. So I wrote back, Annie Hall, Grown Ups, Blazing Saddles, Caddyshack. Thank you. Then she writes back, hey, so I couldn't save the movies. You know, I just get these texts from her, like, constantly while I'm on tour about, like, the little funny things in her life. But that was my favorite. Hey, so I couldn't save the movies. And I'm like, why'd you even tell me that just to torment me with the loss? But she's just funny. So because the funny thing about my daughter is, like, while a devastating thing is happening, while she's having some terrible relationship crisis, like the huge relationship crisis in my daughter's 8th grade life was she got braces. It's one of the big precipitating events in the book. She got braces, and the color brackets that you can pick around your teeth, like what color they're going to be, she got the colors of her middle school, the school colors. She thought this was very, very smart, and everyone would be on board with it. And she got to school, and these 2 girls that were like her mediocre friends, who were like 93% nice and 7% mean, as she puts it in the book, she smiled to show them the braces. And one of them said, oh, that's what you went with? And the other one said, those aren't very feminine colors. You know, and so that is like the hideous, horrible thing. But then at the same time, she'd also be raging about, you know, the fact that the band pants, this is, you know, in the same chapter, the band pants at the school are these thin white polyester band pants. And for any girl who gets her period, it's this gigantic, fearful nightmare because they have to wear these thin white polyester band pants. And she says, if boys got their period, the band pants would be thick black fishing waders. And then she goes on like a 2-page rant about that. And there would, you know, There would be Advil stations every 3 feet in the hallway and cots in the back of every classroom for the boys who were, you know, too pained to go on. And so to my daughter, those things are even. Right in the middle of like a total despair moment, she'll just rant about something and it'll be funny. And so I tried to keep that balance.
I don't want you to think this is creepy, but I just want to follow behind your daughter with a note, like 3 feet behind, like a safe, unnoticeable distance, just like writing down everything. She, like, fishing waders. Keep going.
Advil stations.
Yeah, like right. just for research.
No, that's what I did for a year.
Yeah.
You know, so it's all right. There'll be a little line of novelists behind her.
I think much like Jordan's daughter, like, I learned from my parents that in spite of the things that are happening, the hard things that happen in your life, you have to be able to, well, let's say, find the bright places, if I may. See what I did there? Yeah. all the bright places, folks. But I think that's really true. And I think especially when you're writing books with issues and some hard issues, there needs to be that lightness as well to balance. I think much like life, I mean, I've lost so many people in my life, so many people. But I still have a very inherently happy nature, and I think I'm so thankful for that because it has helped me get through all of those losses. And it's not that I don't feel them very, very deeply, but it does help you. It does help you get from thing to thing. And I will say Holding Up the Universe is a little bit lighter than my first YA book, and I've had people ask, you know, if All the Bright Places, I needed about 10 boxes of Kleenex to get through. How many do I need for Holding Up the Universe? And I say, about 5. So, you know, it was fun to get to write a lighter book than that, even as it's dealing with heavier stuff.
I like the tissue box scale. Yeah, I mean, one of the things I wanted to make sure, and one of the reasons I wanted to write like a sort of classical mystery was I wanted my characters to be going through the world and doing things. So there are these issues taking place, but also Imogene and her friend are breaking into poorly guarded hospital record rooms and like staking out the parking lot of a building that may belong to a long lost aunt or something like that. And they're doing things, they're moving through the world. And I remember when my book was on sub, one editor, No Salt, said they couldn't understand why in the middle of Imogene's father being missing and them dealing with these things, like they were taking a quick break to go to a thrift store to look for prom dresses. And I was like, well, what are they gonna do? Just like sit in a car and right. be sad about it? I mean, like you have to keep going, you have to keep moving. And so I definitely wanted them to be doing that throughout the course of this book. So it's not just kind of like sitting in one place thinking about, you know, boy, my life is really crappy right now, but interacting with the world and there's like humor and there's joy that just comes from that process, so.
Yeah, no, I think, it's what life is like. There's bright places in the dark, sadness, and especially in my family, my dad was a big, he has passed away 7 years ago, but he was a funny, funny guy, and that's what I remember about him, even when he was dying, that we were just laughing so much, and we'd be crying and laughing, I think that's why we can write about these kind of hard issues, because if it's all just darkness and sadness and no humorous rants, you know, no fun things. I think that's not what life is like. You still have to live, you know. Mm-hmm. I remember my friends were asking me, what was your last conversation with your dad? Like, was it, you know, like it was the last words and all that? And I said, you know what, it's so funny. Like, it never even occurred to us because my dad was so, I mean, we feel like we won the dad lottery. You know, like there was no need to say anything because his whole life he had told us how much he loved us, mm-hmm. and we lived in that, and we felt it. And so our last conversation was about David Letterman. So, I mean, it was like, that's what we talked about.
I would just piggyback on that as an author, you kind of collect these moments where there's tremendous potential for sorrow, and it turns around to be funny. If you're fortunate enough to have had that kind of people in your life, you kind of collect them. So I had a great Aunt Sylvia, who was like the most tart person I've ever met in my life. She just has this incredibly tart sense of humor. And it somehow has resonated down through the family to my kids who haven't even met her. But the last time I saw her, she had had like 3 strokes and she was in a wheelchair. It was at her sister's funeral. Mm-hmm. And I was carrying her. I was putting her back in her car. And so I was lifting her. My arms were around her. And I'm trying to get my arm out from under her butt. So I'm like literally wrapped around her. And I whispered in her ear. I knew this was going to be the last time I saw her. And I said, I just have to tell you, Aunt Sylvia, I love you very much. And she said, well, one should hope so. and you kind of collect those moments, I think, as an author. Especially, like, we're like the walking wounded up here. We have all these things. But you collect people who turn it into funny things.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
All right. So we're going to open up to audience questions. So does anybody have a question? Yes.
No.
Thank you. First of all, thank you so much for those lovely words that are very appreciated. The question is how I came up with the character of Theodore Finch in All the Bright Places. I came up with Finch. Finch was inspired by a boy I loved. I knew this boy years ago, and I just saw firsthand what it was for him, just the struggle it was for him to be in the world every single day. He was actually diagnosed bipolar, unlike Finch, who was undiagnosed bipolar, and he struggled with depression and OCD as well, and it was just such a fight for him every single day, but at the same time, he was one of the most magical people I've ever known and one of the most alive people. And knowing him was just a very profound experience, and I knew I wanted to write about it, but because it was so personal, and it was a sad experience and a lovely experience, I didn't know that I could sit down and actually do that. But Finch really began with him, and I did research by talking to experts and talking to people who I know and love who struggle with bipolar, who struggle with depression. But the thing that informed it the most is that boy. Mm. Yeah. Thank you for asking.
Are there any other questions? Oh, thank you.
I suppose we can stand up. There's a mic there. Oh, there's a mic.
Oh. Oh.
Even better. Hi, everyone. So a couple of you guys mentioned research that you did for your books, and I was wondering if you guys had any specific, like, interesting or funny moments while you were researching a la Libba Bray, getting to explore the New York subway, or Kim Savage rolling down a hill in a sleeping bag in a forest.
I'll take that first. Again, it's my daughter. I once, for a book that I haven't written yet, I have this great scene in my head where a character is forced to dig his own grave. I haven't written the book yet, but my daughter was like 7 at the time, and she was a veteran of my writing. She knew the ropes, whatever. So I dug this grave, and so I called the cemetery where my dad is buried in New York, because I figured, like, I was sort of a customer. They would talk to me, you know. So I call, and the grave digger, like the head of digging graves, was super excited to talk about his job. Because, like, I got the feeling he had never been asked. And, like, I got the feeling, like, if he's at a party, his wife, like, shoves him in the corner, and they're like, what do you do? She's like, honey, go get us more drinks or whatever. And he was so excited to talk about this. So he spent like half an hour on the phone with me. He's like, there's 3 things you got to watch out for. It's not hard digging a grave by hand unless you have rocky soil, clay, or a hard freeze. So I go out into my backyard, and like within 3 inches, I've got like the trifecta. I'm like, bam, wham, it's February, and I'm hitting all this like rock and clay and freeze. So anyway, I spent 3 days in my backyard digging this grave. And these high school kids are cutting through my backyard to get to school. And these 2 boys and 2 girls come into my backyard, and I'm like 4 feet down, you know, my head sticking up above the thing and throwing dirt. And they look in, and I'm like, and they run. Okay. So, but anyway, so in the spring, like in the winter, you know, you don't see your neighbors much. In the spring, my daughter is selling Girl Scout cookies. She's 8 years old by then. She's selling Girl Scout cookies, and the nosy old lady next door says to my daughter, so honey, why was Daddy digging that hole in the backyard? And my daughter looks at her and goes, for research, and walks away.
That is the best research story I've ever heard, by the way.
Thank you. Now if I would just write the book.
Oh, you have to write the book. I want to read the book. Some of the research I did for All the Bright Places was really fun. And it was for the movie version as opposed to the actual book. But last April, I traveled to Indiana, which is where the book is set, with the film's producers and the director, my literary agent, and my fiancé. And we rented cars, and we took a caravan across the state, and we went to all the places that Finch and Violet wandered in the book. Aww. And it was awesome, especially to bring this, like, this very art- artsy, like Puerto Rican, now lives in Los Angeles director, and these very like New York like producers who now live in LA, and like everyone's very Hollywood, and like it was so fun to go to a Cracker Barrel with them. That was awesome. But I think the most fun for us was we did go to the world's biggest ball of paint and we painted and everything. But my favorite was the backyard roller coaster. We loved it. And the men were so sad because there's a 200-pound weight limit. So they, none of them were able to, like, ride it. But Miguel, the director, is now on what he calls the blue flash diet so that when we go back to shoot it, he will be able to ride it. But we rode, all the women, we rode the roller coaster. And it was just, my neck will never be the same, but it was amazing.
Oh, my research is like way less compelling than like roller coasters and talking to the head grave digger.
And actually digging.
He was awesome. Yeah. I'd give you his number.
Not like not like the treasure of grave giving the head. So mine was, I mean, something boring. Like I wanted in my mystery for it not to be the kind of mystery where you stop halfway through and wonder like, how does she have the funds to be motoring all around Massachusetts and like, who has that gas money? I didn't have that gas money. I was paying, like, I shared a car with my twin sister when I was in high school, and it was like, you can't bring the car home with under a quarter of a tank. So I would, like, stop at the gas station two blocks away and put $5 worth of gas and, like, park in the driveway and be like, it's on the mine, it's on the line, it's a quarter. So I kept, like, a little bank book for my character to be like, oh, she bought a pretzel on day two. That's minus $3. She gained $50 from, like, her stepmother. So I had a bank book that's, I think, more interesting, at least to myself, is the evidence in the final book of, like, the research I didn't feel like doing. And then I'm like, little stuff, like, when you're lazy and you just don't want to think up a character name or look up a character name, so you, like, put the name of someone you know in there or, like, a place, like a hometown or something. So I remember one of my best friends who she's kind of, like, partly who the best friend in this book was based off of. But she was reading the ARC advanced reader copy. And she was like, did you mean, by the way, on page 5, to put the name of your ex-boyfriend in this book, in the town that is, like, clearly Torrington because it has the same bicycle shop and, like, the same bakery and everything. I just want to let you know that, like, if you're okay with him reading that, that's totally fine. So I was like, oh, my God. So I had to call my editor or email my editor and be like, my ex-boyfriend's name is on page 5. Can we sub that out for just anything else? So some Easter eggs for those of you maybe who graduated like class of 2004 in Torrington, Connecticut, but otherwise you probably won't see my lack of research.
Yeah. A lot of the research for the book I just did on the computer, but I feel like I lived, going through the immigration process. And one of the things I always remember is, so my family had a scuzzy immigration lawyer who didn't file our papers, and so we were waiting. When I was in high school, we were waiting, and nothing happened. And finally, my dad found out that this guy had just taken our money but never filed. So my dad decided he would just file on his own. He was like, you know what? I can follow directions. Like, why did we need a lawyer? Like, everybody's scared, so they hire lawyers. He was like, you know what? I'm just going to file. So when my dad filed, again, it was like 5 years later. And by the time my parents got their green cards, my sister and I were over the age of 21. So back then in the 80s, there was no law that covered the adult children of legal immigrants. And that loophole is now closed. Like, if your parents brought you here as a child and they get their green cards and you're over the age of 21, you get yours at the same time. But back then, you didn't. So so we had to file again. So my sister and I had to file again. And the wait is really, really long. And they said, you know, we could work. We could stay in the country, we could work. But we probably couldn't leave. They were like, probably just stay here and wait. So it was so long that I finally graduated from college, got a job, met my husband, who was then my boyfriend. So we were going to get married, and we decided that we would try to get my green card early so we could go to Europe for our honeymoon. But sadly, it was after 9/11, and however, long the immigration process was. It was doubly long, so we did not get it. So I remember my husband coming with me to the immigration offices. So you would go, and you would get a number, and you would sit in this huge, vast room. And he said, oh, my God, this is like the DMV, but 1,000 times worse. And, you know, I just remember that because, like, I'd been going to the immigration office with my dad, with my family, and it would never occur to us that this was a terrible and long process. But, and my husband would be like, oh my God, Americans cannot stand for this, you know? And I said, well, that's the problem, it's for immigrants, we're not American. But he was just so shocked, and I remember how shocked he was that we had to go through this process that was so cumbersome and so long, so, and that's in the book.
So. One more question.
Everyone's shy. Oh, here we go.
Rachel. What are you reading now? What are you reading right now?
Yeah. What am I reading right now? What am I reading right now? Reading Jeff Zentner's really super brilliant book, which I actually think I brought with me, so I'll hold it up as a free advertisement.
Can I take a picture of you for Jeff?
Yes, absolutely. So, young adult author Jeff Zentner wrote this brilliant book called The Serpent King, about three teenagers growing up at various socioeconomic levels with various things going on in Tennessee. It's really super good. And I was on a panel with him last week in Illinois, and I was so impressed by what he said and how he presented it and his just general air of brilliance and veritas that I bought it. And then on deck after that is another one of our panelists, Brendan Kiley, who was also brilliantly well-spoken and incredible. I'm just going to line up everything Brendan has written and binge on that next. And then Bruce Springsteen's autobiography.
Yeah. I'm, because it's, you know, Halloween month, I'm rereading my favorite author, Shirley Jackson. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, I have like three versions of The Haunting of Hill House, and I just bought the new biography of her, and so I'm just kind of rereading, and I've got her essays on writing and on motherhood, and I'm just rereading everything of hers. And I just bought Brendan's new book, too, which has an awesome cover.
Oh,
and
it really does.
Yeah, and he's just so lovely, and I highly recommend Jeff's as well.
Mm. Yeah. I'm reading a lot of books that have yet to be published because that's my job, and I always want to talk about them, but I have to be like, trust me, in 2 to 3 years, you're really going to love this book. But I'm listening. The best thing I ever did, because I have, like, some days I go into Boston to work and I have a 6-hour commute round trip, and I got an Audible subscription, and that's how I'm making my way through a lot of the YA books that came out this year, and I'm currently listening to, and it's fantastic narration, Zoraida Cordova's Labyrinth Lost, and it is like the perfect Halloween-y month read. It is beautiful, fantastic, so I super recommend it.
I like to read in genres that I don't write in, so I read a lot of inspirational memoirs and cooking memoirs, and I was in the airport, and I had finished, I had just read, I also read a lot of bestsellers, so I like to read what people are reading. I like to kind of know what the culture is, you know, kind of where the wind's blowing. And so I just read, and I loved Maria Semple, so I read her latest book, Today Will Be Different, which is really, really funny. And it's just about, you know, today will be different. Today I will put on pants instead of pajamas. Today I will look people in the eye. You know, so it's, you know, it's about, you know, a creative person. So I really was very, you know, related to it. And the other book that I just bought, so it's day 17 of my tour. I have a hacking cough. You know, I just felt so, you know, worn down. And I bought Shonda Rhimes' Year of Yes, which is amazing. And just made me feel so much better spiritually and mentally that I actually felt a little better physically, too. So I really recommend it. So.
We have time for more. Are we good? Does anybody have any more questions? Did you want to talk about what you're writing next?
Oh. All right. My next book is a middle grade novel. It's coming out this coming summer. It's about a very small, physically weak kid, sixth grader, from a terrible, abusive home life, and he decides he needs to take charge somewhere in his life. His dad died when he was three, leaving him a plastic toy sheriff star, just a cheap plastic toy sheriff star. And the night before sixth grade, to give him courage, he shoves the sheriff star in his pocket to bring to school, and he decides he's going to be the secret sheriff of sixth grade and stand up to the biggest bully in the grade. So the book is called The Secret Sheriff of Sixth Grade.
That's a great title.
Oh, thank you.
Will there be a grave digging?
There's no grave digging in this one.
I was waiting for that.
Yeah, that'll be the sequel, The Dead Sheriff of Sixth Grade. Oh, there we go.
I'm writing the script for the All the Bright Places movie. Yay! Very excited. And I am also just starting work on I have about 12 chapters on YA book number 3. Which I'm really excited about, and I can't talk about yet, but I'm super excited. It's slightly different from All the Bright Places and Holding Up the Universe. And I'm working on a YA collaboration with a secret collaborator, and we've just sent the book to our agents.
So mysterious and exciting. I just finished line edits on my second book, which is coming out next fall. Which is about a girl who grew up in a small town in New Mexico, kind of like where I lived when I was out there. And after she graduates high school, her father has been diagnosed with an illness that she might inherit. And she kind of scraps her plans to go away to school and instead takes a job as a performing mermaid at this like C-list water park outside of Albuquerque. And it's a book that I'm really excited about. And it's not that this isn't the book of my heart, but this is another book of my heart. And it's LGBTQ contemporary. And now I've just started and I'm halfway, like a third of the way through the third book, which is magic realism that sort of involves Baba Yaga.
So in about 3 weeks, I have another book coming out from Penguin, which is, I know, this is a big year. It's like a 5-book year, which is kind of crazy. But I didn't write all the books at the same time. Like some of them were written like a year ago, and some of them were written, you know, a couple months before pub. but they all seem to have published this year. So the second book in the Summer on East End series, which was the YA spinoff of the Witches of East End series, is coming out November 8th. So vote and then go get some sexy witches. So and I'm also working. And then I'm working on the third book in the Isle of the Lost series, with Descendants, which is going to come out before the second movie, which is really fun. And then I have a bunch of other projects that haven't been announced yet that I'm working on. So, yeah, I know. It's like no wonder the hacking.
All right, so we're going to set up to do the signing. Yay.